Hi, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for the wonderful charity Help Musicians. I'm thrilled to say that in this episode I will be joined by the singer of a Scottish electro-pop band, and they've enjoyed the swift journey to the heady heights of pop fame. And they take their influences from bands like New Order, Depeche Mode, Kate Bush and Prince. They've released 4 albums and enjoyed global success. They're currently on tour with Coldplay, which is amazing. They've also played at the Royal Albert Hall and recorded at Berlin's legendary Hansa Studios, 2 amazing things on most bands' bucket list. So please welcome Lauren Mabry of the fantastic band Churches. Hey Lauren, welcome to this podcast for Help Musicians. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm great, and it's good to see a gold disc on a wall. That's kind of a rare thing these days.
Well, yes, I mean, it's the only one we have, and it's an old one, but I'm still pleased to have it. And I get it out when company come round, so I thought I would put it up for this.
Because the music industry has changed quite significantly, I guess, since that gold disc was sent to you. How is the music industry for you now?
I mean, I guess I've been thinking a lot about it in the last 6 months or so, because it's almost 10 years since the first Churches album, so people bring it up to us a lot when we do interviews. And in some ways it does feel like 10 years has passed, and in other ways it doesn't, because you've just been keep getting your head in and working and making things and not thinking about it. But when I zoom out of all of that and think about what my job is like day to day now compared to what it was like then, it is very different. Like, we got signed off the back of like a wave of SoundCloud stuff and blogs, and when we were signed people were already buying tickets because of blogs, and that seems kind of crazy to think about now. Like, Hype Machine was a big thing, and I do think that a band like us on paper probably wouldn't have been that appealing to a label, so I think we kind of snuck in the side door while everybody was freaking out about the internet and what the internet was doing to music. And I think somebody said to me the other day that the first Churches album, which is the one that disc is for, came out the same year as Spotify. Wow. Or like we launched at the same time. So that feels quite odd. And I remember like things like, I remember being on one of the first Churches tours and being told by our manager we should get Instagram. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And I remember texting him back and being like, yeah, I'll have to do it when I get to the venue because I can't do it in the van on my laptop. And he was like, you don't need a laptop. And I was like, what? Like, that was baffling to me. So, yes, a lot has changed. And now I think all those things are such an inherent part of your day-to-day as a musician, and they didn't exist when we started this band. So, yes, sometimes I feel very lucky. In some ways, very lucky that we didn't overthink certain parts of that. Yes, we didn't know some of the pitfalls of streaming or social media or those things, but we just used it normally. That wasn't super curated in a way, so I think that kind of gives you a more normal persona on it, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I was working with a band a couple of years ago, and they used to come off stage and go in the dressing room and look on their phones to see how well they'd gone down. And I just thought, oh no, that's kind of odd.
Well, but in some ways I wonder if people who are a few years younger than me and are in bands now, if they had experienced this kind of social media in a very normal way in their lives before they were in a band, maybe they understand it better. I don't know. We just kind of, it's good in some ways that we weren't overthinking it, but in other ways I think we just all dove in. And maybe the millennials like myself are more obsessed with the critique, maybe. I'm not sure. Can't say. Yeah. Don't know.
And also that I remember this particular band's record company were only really interested in how many people were following them on Facebook and on Twitter. It seemed that they would only advance their record deal if it was up to the numbers that they needed.
Mm. I see a lot of articles. Somebody sent me an article the other day of Ian MacKaye talking about the problems with the contemporary music industry. And I read it and I was like, I agree with most of these things, but I don't want to be that person that's however many years into their career and just like shaking their fist at the sky about certain things, because people did that in the 2000s about how music was so amazing in the 90s, and people did that in the 90s about how amazing it was in the 80s. And I do think, I don't know, I was like, labels always signed shit that they thought was going to be popular, And I'm not saying that that's correct in terms of like trying to get great art out into the universe and helping people find things that are good. But, you know, back in the day, it would be like an A&R guy would come to your show to see if people were actually turning up. And now they can do it by looking at the phone. And I don't know. I do see the positives of having, like, without social media, yes, some terrible things wouldn't have happened. But I also wouldn't have been able to, I don't know, curate a space where people can get what I think is a more accurate representation of me. Not that I read them anymore, but I don't think I've ever read an interview of ours and thought, oh yeah, they really put across me as I know myself to be. And obviously you're creating a certain kind of persona of yourself for the internet, but you know, without the ability to do that, if all people ever got about me was what they heard in the songs and then what mostly male music critics wrote about me, then it'd be very, I think that'd be a very sad place for me to live. So I'm grateful to have the opportunity to be like, hi guys, I'm not actually as that man has described me. So here's an alternative. And neither is technically fully true, I suppose, because it's all coming through a filter in some way. But I think it's nicer to know that you have that sort of. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems that social media has kind of cramped a lot of people's styles. A lot of people do very well out of it. I mean, like Ed Sheeran was saying that he could fill stadiums in Brazil and yet not have a record out, which I always find extraordinary. And I was talking to Youngblood about this just recently. He's just been in South America and playing massive venues there and here, but he doesn't sell any records. So it's a different animal than what it was when I was younger anyway, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, and even for us, I feel like The Bones of What You Believe getting a gold disc, I don't think would happen now. Even if the same number of people listen to it, people aren't buying records in the same way that they were. But we still have consistent tickets. Like, we still do very well live, and that's mostly where our business has always been. So
Yeah.
And I guess I'm like, I don't know. I don't see what good comes of, like, berating people for not buying records, because when was the last time I bought a record? You know? Other than that, I go into shops and I'll buy a vinyl to play at home, or like, so I'll pre-order certain albums and things, but I don't buy every single album that I listen to anymore. And if I was 20 and Spotify had existed, 100% I would have used it. Like, I was saving up to buy an important record once a month, twice a month. But then, you know, other times people were burning UCDs, or you were being very cheeky and getting it off LimeWire. And things that you shouldn't have been doing. So, you know, I think people are always going to want to find music, and you can't, I don't know, I always feel a bit funny when musicians, especially ones of a certain stature, get annoyed at their fan base for not buying their records. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Yeah, this is tricky. Yeah. It's a tricky issue. Yeah.
What was the first record that you bought that you couldn't put down? You took home and you put it on and you just couldn't put it down.
Ooh. I guess, well, I was a child of the late 80s, early 90s in Britain, so there was a lot of, like, pop cassettes, a lot of cassette singles, a lot of Now compilations. That was a big deal when the Now compilation would come out. And I remember being very excited to get the first Spice Girls album. I got that on cassette for Christmas, I think, and then just, I think, ruined my family's life with it for the next year and a bit. I remember, my dad worked in Newcastle for a while, so we would do... Oh no, my uncle worked in Newcastle for a while, and my dad would go down there sometimes. And yeah, so for some reason, we're driving down that stretch of motorway a lot, and we would stop at service stations and get just those shit service station CDs. You get, like, Best of Soul, Best of Country. And I remember getting a copy of Tragic Kingdom in a petrol station once, which in hindsight means that record must already have been massive and out for several years. Because otherwise it would not be in, like, the BP petrol station. But yes, I remember being very, just even the cover of it and, like, being obsessed with the inlay of that album and just that image of Gwen Stefani in that time. And she was the only woman in the band, and she was like an otherworldly creature to me. And her voice was so specific. Even now, I'm like, I could pick Gwen out of a lineup wherever she is. I would know her by her sound of her voice. And I do think for a young girl who had been immersed in, like, a lot of pop music, and I excuse the Spice Girls from this because so much of their songs weren't about romance and weren't about love and were about friendship and living and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, hearing songs like Don't Speak or Just a Girl, I was like, what? My mind was blown. I was like, this isn't Boyzone. What's happening? and no disrespect to Boyzone, which was my first concert. So
Oh, that was your first concert.
It was, yes. My sister and a family friend's daughter took us. So, yes, I remember getting so overexcited and overheated I had to sit down.
No.
So, yes, it was a very formative time, Boyzone.
Did you come away from the stage thinking, that's where I want to be? I want to be on that stage.
No. No.
You didn't think you wanted to have your own band and do that?
I think I always loved it, and I was always very obsessive about pop bands, especially girl bands. And then, like, Natalie Imbruglia, that album was very important for me at that time. And then moving into No Doubt and Garbage and Alanis Morissette and things like that, I thought were very exciting. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It never really occurred to me until I was fully a teenager that I wanted to be in a band. And even then, never really thought that much about being the singer. Like, I loved singers. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with Whitney Houston, and it was always something I really loved, but I never thought that I would do it necessarily. Yeah, there was definitely moments in my teens where, when you were hanging out with girls at school, everyone would be talking about which band member they fancied, and that was always the narrative when you're a young girl, is that you have to choose the one out of the band. But now it was rock bands instead of pop bands, and I don't know, I just remember being like, I don't really want to date Tom DeLonge. I kind of want to be Tom DeLonge, or I want to be Travis Barker, or any of these things. And now I'm like, oh yeah, the lyrics of Blink-182 are not for teenage girls. That's me as a grown woman is like, oh no, that's not good. But at the time, you didn't know. And then I think to me, I was like, well, the way to get into it is that maybe I could play drums in it, or I could play keyboards in it. I never really thought, maybe because I hold the likes of Gwen Stefani in such high esteem, I would never assume that I could do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It was a strange roundabout way to get to it, I suppose.
Do you ever co-write outside of the band?
Yes, we've done a bit of that. On the third Churches album, we did a little bit, and we've each done things outside of it, writing for other people and just trying things.
Does that work? Is it something that you clash about, or is it something you enjoy?
I think it's come to be something I enjoyed. I think the first time that we did it, other than other bands I've been in, so I've been in three bands in my life, like a high school one, a university one, and Churches. So those are my three main things. I've never really written with people outside of that. So when we first did it, it was on the third Churches album. And I think in hindsight, I think there was a lot of panic and fear involved in that, because after two records, people will be nice to you on your second one if it's good enough, but you can't do the same thing three times, was kind of the narrative. And I think I learned so much from those sessions, and I really enjoyed them because a lot of them, because it felt like a breath of fresh air into the writing room, because there was another person who would ask me directly about, what are you trying to say, and what are your lyrics about, and that's not something that's never how we start songs in Churches, but it just showed me that it's good to go seeking things if you're really open to it and excited about it, but you know what you're looking for, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think we were just kind of like blindly seeking in a way that felt quite fearful for a lot of that.
Oh, I know that. I know that feeling very well.
But then other times I've gone into writing sessions with people and I've been in a calmer, more grounded headspace or something, and then you've written something that totally wasn't what you expected, but you really like it. And I think that's just about the headspace that you're in and how you frame it. And I don't know, I've come around to the idea that you can learn something from every session that you ever do, whether it's a good one or a bad one, you learn something from that. And I guess it's more about figuring out what your perspective is and what your point of view is, and then what you can do with that. But they don't scare me as much as they used to, but it's shown me that it's a lot like dating, I think. I know pretty early on into a session with somebody, about 10 minutes in, I'll be like, I'm not going to write a good song with this man. It's always with that man. And I'm like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But then sometimes...
That's so true.
Yeah, it's just chemistry, I suppose. And I kind of like that. You can overthink the music industry as much as you like, but at the end of the day...
It's chemistry.
There is something about... Yeah, you cannot know somebody at all and get on really well and have... Like 2 hours later, you've got something really exciting. You can think this person's really nice, but you just don't have the thing with them. And I'm like, that's been an interesting thing to learn.
Yeah, it's a shared chemistry. It's a kind of spiritual thing, I find, that when you're in a room with somebody, you don't question the process. You just take part in it. And you know that the outcome is going to be just a sort of magical twist on how you thought it would be. You're right, you know, you learn so much about yourself when you're writing with people for the first time. It is like dating, I agree.
And I think, especially for me with lyrics, I used to feel really bad, especially as the person that's not the producer in the band. I am the only non-technical person in churches. And sometimes, for whatever reason, I can think something is like really good and they've done a really good job, but for some reason, it's just not resonating with me correctly. And then I'll try really hard to write the lyrics on it because I know that's the right thing to do. And they're never good when I have to push them out in that way.
Exactly.
I used to feel really guilty about that or really bad about that, or be like, I'm not good enough, I'm letting everybody down, they're going to be so pissed off with me and things like that. Because I get it, it would be annoying if you'd spent all day working on something and then the fucking singer comes in and is like, I'm not feeling it. Like, that would be so irritating and not correct. They'd be like, well, academically, this could be really good and somebody else could really love it. But I guess, I don't know, to me, I've come to think that you need to have a respect for whatever that divine thing is. If you're just, for some reason, not connecting on it, you should put it to the side, come back to it. But if it doesn't work, it just doesn't work.
I agree, totally. Are you disciplined?
I think I can be. I try to be disciplined with, like, I'll write a little something every day, mostly words. I think that that helps me to overwrite on the word banking front. Just so then I have a bunch of ideas when I come into a writing session or when the guys send an instrumental, then I'll be able to look through the book and pick out a word or a phrase. Or sometimes if I've written something down, like, there'll be one phrase in it that'll keep coming back round. And now when I do writing sessions outside of the band, I'll go in with a concept or with a little lyric. So yeah, I'm a words guy, I think, at the end of the day.
How much of yourself do you reveal through your words? I'm always tripping myself up with the things that I say. Some people are not very pleased about some of the words that I come up with.
I've come to terms with the fact that, like, lyric writing, I think, is almost the place where I'm most honest, more so than I am in actual speech to other humans.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's because of what I've listened to or the artists that I like. I think there's nothing more special for me than when you hear a song that describes a feeling that you've had but maybe not fully articulated to somebody else. And I think that that's really special if you can do that. But yeah, I look at things in the past where I'm like, I've definitely had a better line for something and I've taken it out because I didn't want it to upset someone. Or
right. It is a kind of therapy, I think.
Yeah, I do think so, because I think, I don't know, a lot of the time when I'm talking to other people, everybody will always edit themselves back a little bit because you don't want to, you don't want to be a massive bummer when you're out and about places. Or certain things that are like existential. I don't want to be sitting like in the pub or the coffee shop with somebody and then just be like, dying, thoughts on, discuss. Like, it has to be the right moment for those kind of conversations, you know? And I do think that in a way, turning it into, I don't know, maybe even just turning it into four lines that rhyme makes it feel better or something.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Hi, I'm Jazz Beeson. I'm an artist, a songwriter and a producer, and I'm from a town called Grimsby in Lincolnshire. I make sort of indie pop music, and yeah, I've been lucky to receive some funding from Help Musicians last year to help me with my artist journey. I happened to fall into guitar lessons in school. They just happened to be offered. And I went, do you know what? Yeah, I'll give that a go. And I was really, really a terrible student, I'll be honest. I didn't do the practicing. I didn't like doing the scales and all the theory behind it. But I did like chords and the potential that you could use them to write songs. So my guitar teacher worked with me a lot and worked with the fact that I was a bit of a difficult student to get the best out of me, really, and to get me writing songs. I was just very aware that I had something to say and that song and lyrics especially was like a way that I expressed myself as quite a sensitive teenager, and he helped me facilitate that. And then when I started making my own music, I was drawing from my experiences of coming from a small town and somewhere that's sort of on the edge of nowhere, and really drawing from that as I started to write songs. So a big influence for me in terms of lyric writing was definitely Taylor Swift. It's quite a classic answer for many young singer-songwriters, but honestly, her lyricism and the way she made the absolute end of the world teenage dramas so fairy tale poetic, I found really, really beautiful. And she made me want to play around with metaphor and intricate lyricism. I love to be clever with my writing. It can be so simple lyrically, but it can mean so many different things, and that's what I love about Taylor and her work. I was very lucky to study a degree in songwriting. I didn't know they existed till I was about 17 and applying for uni. And my teacher at the time was like, hey, you know, this thing exists, this space for you to work on your songwriting for 3 straight years, and really threw yourself into it. And I was very lucky to be able to do that at a great university in London called ICMP. And from there, it sort of took me into my career. A couple of highlights for me: I got to play a festival up north called Humber Street Sesh, which I thought was really fun. And recently I've now got a band to sort of support the live side of what I do. As a band, we got to really look at each other for the first time and think, this is so ace what we're doing. And we were so lucky to be in that moment, and we got to bond on this road trip. And honestly, I'm learning so much about myself in this process of music and being a musician, and it's all about the people you meet, and whether you write about them, whether you collaborate with them, it's so much about connection, and I find that really important. There's always moments of doubt as a musician. There's always times where you feel less confident in your work. Sometimes it comes from comparison. I also have found that I've struggled with loneliness a little bit, especially at university, moving away from a tiny town to a city like London, which is where I've been studying. I found myself quite isolated, and I had to learn a lot of tools to overcome that. And luckily, surrounding myself with this community of people has helped with that a lot. And then my family as well. Like, I really am grateful to have such a supportive family who want to champion what I do. So they're always there to chat to if I need it. Help Musicians last year offered me the opportunity to come to a Culture of Belonging workshop with Catherine Ann Davis, and they allowed us the space and agency to create, to learn, to make mistakes with other women in music production. We were all at different levels. I was learning so much from the women I was there with, and it was a really, really empowering weekend. And we got to use Radiohead's former desk, which was so cool. And I learned about patching, which I'd never done before. And I'd never really worked on a full-on studio desk like that. I'd worked on a home studio a lot, but honestly, getting to work on the buttons on an analog desk. And I now feel as though I've learned this really cool skill that I can take forward with me. If I go into another studio, I'll understand a lot more about the equipment. I'll understand the different bits of gear and hardware and what that compressor does, as opposed to pressing a button on Logic. If anyone has the opportunity to apply for something similar, I know they've been running multiple of these workshops now because of the success of it, I would recommend it, because I found it so, so empowering to have conviction in what we're saying and trusting our gut feeling as a producer as to the ideas we want to get across. And having this production weekend, it was helping us to speak up essentially and learn the skills, and one, call out things that we might think aren't quite okay, but two, being able to assert ourselves in the same way that men do. We just have to be confident in ourselves in whichever way that we express that. If you're feeling like you could do with some support to help you along with your career, don't be afraid to reach out and ask the question. The people around you, your support system, ask Help Musicians. And especially for women and non-binary people, if we're talking about this production weekend that I've just been on, don't be scared to ask for the money, ask for the funding. It's been proven that women are statistically less likely to submit these applications. It's good practice as well to ask for help when you feel like you need it, whether you're struggling or whether you just want a bit of a boost in your career.
Music Minds Matter from Help Musicians is available 24/7 to anyone who works in music. Call us for free to speak to an accredited counsellor who can offer you emotional support, advice and information. It doesn't have to be a crisis or even about music. If you work in music and are struggling to cope, then Music Minds Matter is here for you. Simply call 0808 802 8008 or visit musicmindsmatter.org.uk to receive support today.
You know, touring can be quite, I find anyway, lots of long hours. You can be quite stressful away from your roots, your home, whatever. It can be a hard life, although it's great fun for the 90 minutes that you're on stage. Have you ever thought that there might be a different path that you would take? I know that I have.
Maybe I was the correct age when I started touring it. I do have a real fondness for touring, because I guess I'd been in a band since I was a teenager, but we hadn't done a lot of touring, really, because we couldn't get arrested. Couldn't get anybody to book the band. I think, like, once or twice a year, we would make our pilgrimage to London and play for 12 people, try and get a Manchester gig, a Leeds gig, on the way back up the road. But really, it would be just so terrible. So it feels very privileged to say, but outside of, like, Scottish shows, I hadn't done very much touring at all before Churches happened. And then we did all the touring that could possibly exist. I think we counted it once and we played 365 shows in 2 years. And I was like, that's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot.
But I look at it, I'm like, yeah, I was 23 when we started the band, 24 when we started playing shows. And I guess I was so thirsty to do it because I'd never done it. And pretty quickly we were in a bus, which is very privileged, so
comfy.
So I didn't do as much of the van touring as the guys did, so yes, I think I've had a cushier experience with it. But also I think it was just what had to be done, and all the other guys in the band, and our manager had been a tour manager, he'd been a front of house, and he was very smart and was like, this is where we're gonna make business, is by becoming a good live band and touring in that way. So I think I was always like, yep, this is just how it is, this is what you do. I do think it's been a learning curve to figure out how to do that in a way that's slightly healthier for the brain, especially as most of the time I'm the only woman on the road. We've had female tour managers, but most of the time the band and the crew have all been straight men. Nothing against straight men, hashtag not all men. But even from just a social point of view, I'm like, that's very odd, because then it means that more than three quarters of my year is spent, that's not what a normal culture is like, that's not what normal society is like. So yeah. I spent most of my teens and 20s to present day learning how to kind of code switch into that environment, and I think happy to have done it, happy to have had all the good experiences, but it is quite odd. I spend a lot of time by myself, and I spend a lot of time with my headphones on. But that's not because of anything bad that anybody's ever done. They're all really good dudes, but it just is. There's only so many Arnold Schwarzenegger films I can watch. Like, there's only so much I can do.
Tap. You can't watch Spinal Tap too many times.
You know? And I think I'm proud of it in a way, because when I look at things, I'm like, I was a kid when I started joining bands. And I think now I have a better balance. I was so conscious of, you have to be one of the guys enough that they let you in and they accept you as part of it so that you're allowed to do the thing that you want to do. But then I do think, I'm like, you didn't really get to experience girlhood properly, if that makes sense, because it was always framed in that context. And I look back on certain things, I'm like, would I drink as much, swear as much, make as many lewd jokes if I hadn't come up in that experience? I'm like, maybe not. But I think now, as a woman in my 30s, I'm like, okay, I can find the balance of that and be grateful for the parts of me that that formed. But also, yeah, I look at certain things and I'm like, oh yeah, those guys were always really good at deferring to what I wanted to do in terms of, like, moral or ethical things, or how we ran the business in certain ways. And I think that was very kind of them and really great. And when things would come up where there'd be issues with abuse online, or like stalker people, or inappropriate stuff at shows, or who we play with or who we get booked by, that's always me who's like, these are the things that aren't appropriate. And I think it's great that they made space for me in those conversations. But also, I was 24.
Yeah.
So when people are like, what do you think we should do? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. I think baby me would have really wanted somebody else to be like, here's what we do. And even at like the labels and things like that, I'm like, I don't think that people knew how to assist in that.
Yeah.
Or they didn't even think about it, because it's not just something that wasn't part of the language of how indie rock or alternative touring was.
Can you ever see yourself going in the studio on your own to record?
I do sometimes. Like, I do write things
specifically for you, yeah.
And I think that there's something healthy in that, because I think even if you're the lyricist in the band, you're still, even if you're writing from your point of view, it's still something that needs to be approved by a collective. So I think there's probably something healthy in, like, I write things at home that are not, won't be Churches songs and may never see the light of day. And there's something amazing about being part of a team. But I think if you're constantly, for a people pleaser, I love to do some people pleasing. So it's like, maybe there's something healthy about not focus grouping yourself all the time or something.
Yeah.
But it's a very different experience in positive ways, but also in, it's just very strange to go anywhere. It's very strange to go anywhere without the guys from the band, because
yeah, it's very much a security blanket being in a band, isn't it, sometimes?
Yes, and I think that's the best part of it, is that I do feel like we're a scrappy little unit, and I think that that's been the thing that's kept us alive as a band this long. So, yes, very grateful for that.
Yeah, the chemistry of bands is an interesting topic. You know, sometimes you go on the road and you still don't know the person that you've been on the road with for many, many years. Do you find that?
I think we've all learned a lot about each other, especially the last few years, I think. And I do think you know people in your band so much better than you know a lot of other people in your life who you would think you're closer with, because you can't really hide things when you're on tour. Like, you really come to know the essence of a person at like 4 a.m. in an airport.
Oh God, yes.
Or like broken down at the side of the road or things like that. And I think, yeah, there, you can't really curate yourself in the way that you can with other things. And I do think, like, for me, I got to know Ian and Martin through the band and through touring. I didn't know them before this. They had been friends for a number of years beforehand, and they'd been friends with our manager, and they'd been in bands together. And even then, I think that how they know each other now is completely different to what that was before then. I look back on it, I'm like, that's a bit mental. You didn't know these guys at all. And then 6 months later, you're in a van and you're getting signed, and like, you're like, off we go.
How exciting.
Yeah. I think in a way, also, it's good that I was that young, because I didn't overthink it that much. Just did it. Whereas now I'd be like, wait, what are the pitfalls? Let's do background checks.
If you've got sort of moments where you're kind of delving deep and you're finding yourself to sort of work out what's going on, if there's ever a dark day, is there somebody that you can lean on?
Yeah, I think I'm very lucky that most of my other friends aren't in music, really. I'm lucky that most of my close friends are people that predate the band.
Yeah.
So I think it's nice that when I spend time with those people, they're very, you know, supportive of the band, but it's not what we talk about in our constant day-to-day.
Yeah.
And I think that that's been really helpful, because I think a lot of the time, not a lot of the time, sometimes when I met people through the band, it feels quite strange because you are sort of a concept rather than fully a person. So even when someone's being very kind, they're talking to you as the person from that band.
Band, yeah.
Rather than just a human being, who does dumb stuff sometimes. So I kind of find, for me, most of the time, if I'm writing about something that makes me sad or something that was traumatic in some way, I'll do that after the fact. Like, maybe like the word purge will go into the journal, and then when I actually come to make something out of it, a little distance needs to have passed for it to be, I don't know, made into actual song format rather than just like angry or sad purge about something. But no, I'm very lucky that I have more people to talk to than just my notebook. But my notebook probably gets the
sharpest pen.
The most unfiltered version.
Oh, I'd love to read that. It'd be amazing.
It'd be like, people find it and be like, what a sad handwritten book.
Well, hold on one second. I've been keeping these for many, many years, and they're all handwritten too.
It's lovely when you... Maybe this is my own narcissism showing... Oh, that's the recycling outside, just in case that pops up on the... maybe this is my own narcissism just peeking through, but I do like it when you're going through old notebooks or you happen upon one and you look back and you see things. Or I always write out every part of the song. Even if I've written something down on my phone, I'll always put it in the notebook because I want it there to be an archived version of it somehow. And some things I look at and I'm like, oh, how cringe and bad that was. Just bad. How did you ever think that was going to be good? But then other things I'll look at and be like, oh, I can see where this song came from. Or it's kind of nice to have a snapshot of yourself at that time or something. And maybe that's just the ego for me. But I do think if I make it to be an old lady, then I'll want these things, I think.
I've just opened up my diary on the 25th of April, 1973.
Ooh.
It says, no work today. Hung around with Chris all day, whoever that was. Went and bought some David Bowie tickets.
Not a bad day, all things considered.
Did you ever see David Bowie?
I did not, no, I didn't. Nor do I have any like actual old diaries. I think the journaling diary stuff outside of lyrics, I probably only have like a couple of years maybe. And I do think I'm like, oh man, I kept all those preteen and teenage diaries and then I put them in the bin of like shame of it, and now I think that's quite sad. I was like, oh, like I kind of wish I had those. I wonder, I was like, oh yeah, the learning of being ashamed of the things that you think and what people might think of those. That's an interesting moment in time.
Well, he recorded at Hansa Studios and so did you. What was that experience like?
Yes, that was very bonkers and bizarre. We had one day off on a tour and we wanted to make an acoustic version of some songs, and we happened to be in Berlin at the time, and we were like, obviously, let's ask, but surely they won't let us. And then they did. And yeah, it was quite bizarre being in there and just thinking of all the amazing records that have been made in there, but also knowing that we had X number of hours to get all these tracks done. So we were like, everybody enjoy the moment, but not too much, because we've got a lot to do, which I think would sum up the decade of being in churches. Enjoy it, but quickly, because we've got stuff to do.
Enjoy it, but quickly.
Yes.
That's a great quote. That's a really good quote. You're living in LA now?
I am at the moment, yeah, with their noisy trucks getting in the way of our interview. But yes, came out here a few years ago, and my partner's a musician out here, so I'm stuck. I'm stuck now, for the time being.
It's an amazing place to live, though, I think. A lot of people knock Los Angeles, but you've got a lot of good connections to be made there.
Obviously, there's parts of it that are quite cynical that I don't love. It definitely doesn't feel like my forever home, necessarily, but I don't know. They gave me a work visa. I'm going to try it. And I do think if you know what you're looking for, you can find people to make interesting stuff with, if you know what you're trying to find.
Yeah.
I think I can see how it would be easy to get led up paths you don't want to go up, necessarily. But I do think just even like coincidences that have happened and I've ended up writing something with somebody or writing something for somebody, I'm like, I guess that's the purpose of this. It's like, oh, I wouldn't get those opportunities if I was somewhere else. But my partner is British as well, so I think that helps.
Okay.
We can shut the door and be like, what are they? They're all mental. We can like, at least have that thing between us and know that at some point, like our families are still in the UK, so we would like to make the jump at some point. But for the time being, just trying to pet cats and enjoy the sunshine.
What was lockdown like for you? Did you enjoy the break?
It was a lot of sitting in this room.
Was it? Oh, God.
Because I guess we made our last record, the fourth record, over Zoom, essentially. So we had like a couple of weeks of writing and then everything else we did remotely. So, yes, I mean, obviously very cushy and privileged to have been able to work from home. We were very lucky that we just finished 2 years of touring, so we didn't have to cancel a huge number of shows. And yes, I'm very conscious that my experience of lockdown is much more comfortable than a lot of people's. But yeah, I do think that if anything good came out of it, I suppose for me it was probably, like, I'll always write lyrics in another room from the guys, but mostly just because of timeline. Like, they would be producing the song and they would need to be doing that while I was needing to be writing the lyrics. So that's just kind of how the habit developed. But I think having the ability to do a number of drafts and then record a vocal and then send it to them was very different, rather than going in with your piece of paper. Like, I think then I was able to present what I thought the part should be fully. And I think that also maybe being locked in a room by yourself means that you do go down certain existential cul-de-sacs with writing. And I think if the record hadn't been made in that way, I don't know if it would have ended up being the kind of record that it was. So
yeah.
For better or worse, it was a good writing exercise, which is a horrible thing to say, but yeah.
That's good. What are your plans now? Are you out on tour this summer?
We are opening for Coldplay on some shows in the UK and Europe. So we did some South American stuff with them in the springtime. And then, yes, we're doing that. And then we're playing Glastonbury and a couple of festivals in Germany. And then I think that should be, because our album came out in 2021. So I was like, we're dragging that dead horse around to this point. So I think that will be the end of the campaign properly. And then we'll get into the thinking about new music and stuff.
I will see you at Glastonbury. There's a house that I stay in, which is just up the hill. It's about half a mile from the Pyramid Stage. And what we do is we have a host of different songwriters come and join us, and people write songs and then they perform them and eat cheese and drink.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's a lovely thing. You're very welcome to join us with the band.
That sounds much more civilized than anything that we'll be doing. So we'll be drinking warm tenants and I don't know what else.
No.
Other stereotypical things.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. And also there's a really amazing photographer that's going to be there. I know he'd love to take pictures of you. His name's Henry Diltz. He's 84, and he originally took photographs of Joni Mitchell and James Taylor and Crosby, yeah, Stills, Nash and Young. And he's a friend of mine. He's flying over from Los Angeles to take pictures at Glastonbury.
I mean, Joni is just one of my absolute all-time, yeah, faves. Like, she's untouchable, I think.
Yeah. And what's it like touring with Coldplay? I really admire them. A lot of people find them a pain, but I really think Chris is brilliant. And I've tried to get him on my podcast several times, but he's a bit of a slippery fish. He's very difficult to get hold of.
He's squirrely. No, I think they've been so incredibly generous to us. The band specifically and everybody around them are so kind. They've been so good to us. And yeah, what an incredible songwriter that he, like... I think if I had written one of those songs, I'd be like, that's fine. You can push me into the ocean. That's my Viking funeral. I'm done. Yeah, it's insane to watch. Just watching people watch that band, yeah, is a very specific experience, because it is such it's a very joyful show, and people feel very, like, watching people listen to The Scientist. The first few nights I watched it, I just cried to The Scientist because I find that song to be incredibly beautiful. Mm-hmm. But then watching other people experience that, and like a whole stadium of like 70,000 people singing, Nobody Said It Was Easy, But No One Ever Said It Would Be This Hard. I'm like,
oh. Yeah, really?
Oh, you've done me there, Chris. You've done me there. So, yeah, very fun.
Sending my love anyway. But thank you so much, Lauren, for your time. It's very generous of you. I look forward to seeing you at Glastonbury. And
yeah,
I can't wait. Which stage are you on?
I think we're on the other stage.
Oh, I prefer that. I love that stage.
Maybe 6:30?
Yeah.
Maybe? Like, yeah, a kind of pre-sunset-y type vibe, I believe.
Well, thank you very much for your time. You're really kind.
Awesome. Thank you.
I really enjoyed my conversation with Lauren. She's such a vibrant lady, and she knows what she's talking about. She's a great lyricist, which is terrific. And I have to say, I didn't really know a lot about them before the interview, if I'm honest. But I'm all over them now. I can't wait to go and see them play live at Glastonbury. They're amazing. She is amazing. And I want to thank her so much for taking the time. As always, thank you for listening, and please subscribe to this podcast. Supporting Help Musicians in any way at all helps the musicians who bring so much to our lives. To find out more about Help Musicians, you can find them on all social media channels. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.